Perhaps one of the worst ways I could introduce Maggie Kuhn would be to say she's 84 years young. I suspect she would think of that as very patronizing. Kuhn knows she's not young, and she's very proud of her age and what she's achieved in the past 84 years. Maggie Kuhn has probably done more than any single American to challenge our stereotypes of older people and how we so often condemn them to obsolescence. In 1970, Maggie Kuhn turned 65 and was forced to retire from her job with the United Presbyterian Office of Church and Society, where she was program coordinator in the Division of Church and Race. Sorry to be forced to give up her work, she formed the Gray Panthers with several other retired friends. The vision was of an intergenerational movement that would work to stop ageism and that would campaign on behalf of peace and social justice. The Gray Panthers now have more than 80,000 members around the United States, and Kuhn has been honored with numerous awards for her work. She's now the national convener of the Gray Panthers. Maggie Kuhn, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to Fresh Air.
And it's a pleasure to be with you, Terry. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. What are some of the ways that you think older people are patronized by people who mean well?
Well, we become wrinkle babies instead of the elders of the tribe. And we are isolated. In fact, the Older Americans Act codifies age segregation. There's senior centers and senior services. And the RARE Center puts old and young people together and does not violate the continuum that life is. We're all aging, and the aging process begins with the moment of birth. And it continues till rigor mortis.
What advice would you give us all about expressions that sound like they're really flattering, but are, like, really insulting? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you see, I think with senior centers, or seniors, and teenagers, I like to think of ourselves as older Americans. And I call myself an old woman.
What's wrong with senior?
Instead of senior, that's a euphemism. It's denial, in my view. But, of course, it's caught on so widely, and it's hard to get it out of the language.
Now, you started the Gray Panthers in 1970 when you faced mandatory retirement.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you had to give up your job?
I was very depressed and sad because I loved what I was doing. And the mandatory retirement rule I tried to avert, but it was not possible. It was pretty rigid, particularly for women. And so with five of my friends who were in the same predicament, we organized the Consultation for Older and Younger Adults for Social Change. And a television producer in New York said, "You're never going to get anywhere with that name. You're the Gray Panthers." And we said, "Wow, that's for us." And the Black Panthers and the Gray Panthers had close collaborative efforts in those days. And we decided that the issue that we were going to take on was the war in Vietnam, to stand with the draft resistors, to demonstrate in front of the draft boards. That's what we did. And that gave us an immediate entree to young people.
Well, it was interesting. When you started the Gray Panthers in 1970, it was the height of the youth movement.
Yes.
So I think it must have been a challenging time to unite older and younger people.
It was, but around the issue of the war in Vietnam, there was an immediate response.
It was 20 years ago that you started the Gray Panthers. You've changed since then. I mean, you're getting older since then.
Yes.
And what is your health like now?
My health is not as robust as I would like it to be. I have arthritis in both knees and in my hands, and I have great difficulty walking sometimes. I use a cane, and this makes me a member of what the French call l'âge troisième. You know what the third age is. When you can't get along on two legs, you need a third leg. The cane is my third leg.
Do you have to pace yourself differently now than you did a few years ago?
I do, yes. But I have an idea that, in fact, I've tested this in my own life and in the lives of my contemporaries, that when one has a goal, a purpose for living, that we can do a lot of things that we could not do without a goal. And we are reinforced by our own history. We have self-esteem, kind of a sturdy self-esteem, because we've been through a lot of changes. And we're not going to be too worried about them because we'll be able to cope with them.
I'm wondering if you ever feel like you have to push yourself past the point that you'd like to prove something to all the people who admire you so much and who look up to you and to look to you as a role model.
Well, it's an enormous challenge, Terry. And it's humbling, too, because I can't do all that I would like to do. And it may be expected of me. But it seems imperative now in our organization to build a strong intergenerational movement to involve large numbers of young people who will carry on when those of us who are old in the movement become too frail and die. So if we're going to survive and continue to be advocates and to work for social change, peace, and justice, we have to reach out.
I'm wondering if you are angry at certain physical ailments that you have, or
yes,
if you just feel like, well, that's part of getting older. I mean, what's your emotional response to it?
I'm ambivalent about it. I'm glad I've survived, and I'm eternally grateful and privileged and blessed that I'm able to do what I can do. But I do get really frustrated and angry that I can't get up without getting dizzy, that if I forget my cane, I'm in bad shape. And those physical difficulties have to be overcome and dealt with and lived with. And I have to deal with my anger and submerge it to a goal that I believe in that is affirming and hopeful, and move on from there.
I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer that about 2 years ago, you were mugged in your neighborhood. This is a fear a lot of older people have. Everybody has a fear of being mugged, but I think older people are more afraid that they're going to be a target because
yes,
they'll be perceived as very vulnerable. I think
yes,
your purse was snatched.
Yeah.
And you were knocked down. You had a broken shoulder and some facial bruises. You recovered physically from that. What about psychologically? As an older person, were you more afraid to walk the streets, and how did you overcome that fear?
I was really afraid, and the mugging occurred in my neighborhood. I was on my way with one of my housemates to our neighborhood association meeting, three doors from where I live, and it made me worried about the neighborhood. I have twinges in my head when I go past that place. Although I dealt with it at the time, you just move on. But that shock lingers.
So are you more afraid to walk the streets now?
Well, I don't do it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't do it alone because of my difficulty walking,
right,
which is one response. I used to do a lot of walking, and I can't do that anymore. I miss it. And part of it is fear of my own infirmity, and also fear of attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'm just convinced that we've got to find ways in which the young people in our society have a new future and are not involved in drugs and are not involved in purse snatching and mugging to sustain themselves.
Mm-hmm. Maggie Kuhn is my guest. She's the founder of the Gray Panthers. You were never married, never had children. Now, this is a fear that a lot of people have, growing old alone. And I'm sure that one of the things people look to their children for is companionship and support when they get older. Now that you're older yourself, do you have any regrets about that?
And when people ask me why I never married, I say, I just was very lucky. Because I had a number of great love affairs, which I've enjoyed remembering and writing about. And I have a family of choice that has been a part of my life. And for the last almost 30 years, I've shared my house with a variety of young people. Many of them have been students, and some have lived with me for a long time.
You know, I'm sure it was very unusual within your generation to remain intentionally single and
yes.
without children.
Yes.
Now, this is a position that many, many more men and women are choosing now. So a lot of people are looking ahead to choices very similar to the ones
yes.
that you made
yes.
a long time ago. And that's why I'm kind of interested in what your life as an older person has been like, single and without children. I think a fear that a lot of people have is that if they're living with a family of choice, as you describe it, that they'll feel more like a burden on them if they take ill or if they have certain physical problems than they would feel with someone who was part of
yes.
the family. Has that been a problem?
No, it has not. And people come to live with me understanding that may be the situation. And last year when I had surgery and pneumonia, my housemates were most loving and kind. And Marilyn Vowles, who is my assistant, is also a housemate. And she's a loving friend. We have all kinds of joys that we share. And it is the basis of our closeness that there is shared interest. That's a prerequisite. And also, there has to be space. Each of us has our private space, and there is public space or shared space. And that works very well.
I think a question that a lot of people who also don't have children will have is, were you ever sorry that you didn't have children? And you're always sorry about what you didn't do, everything you do in life. You could have had an alternative
yes,
and done something
yes,
else.
Yes, yes.
But some of those regrets are so deep that
yes.
that you really wish you'd made a different choice, and others you just live with.
And I have just lived with that, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have children of my own, but I have other children who are mine by choice. I'm very much interested in the young people of our neighborhood and the babies of the young children of former housemates. They mean a great deal to me. And that contents me and gives me joy.
I'm sure you have friends who are your age who have been less fortunate than you in either their health or in their home situation. I mean,
yes.
I think not everybody is as lucky to find people
yes.
who they feel great companionship with. You've probably had friends who you've had to visit at convalescent homes
yes.
and senior citizen homes.
Yes. Yes.
What do you think about when you go to a nursing home to visit a friend?
It's depressing. And they're so isolated. There are no young people around. And we need young people to be in our lives. And I have more young friends than old friends. Many more. And most of the women my age, outside of the Grey Panthers, have no contact with young people.
I think that some older people choose to live in age-segregated communities.
Yes.
Do you disapprove of that? I mean, it's their choice.
It's their choice, and they they should make their choice. But it seems to me that by building more retirement homes, we are increasing the isolation, the social and political isolation of older Americans. And it seems to me that that is going to deprive our society, because we need their input. And when they are institutionalized, there is very little input.
Do you ever go through a crisis of how responsible you should be toward friends who have health problems and can't really take care of themselves? And I ask you this because everybody has to go through this, whether it's with family or with friends. How much of your time you will put into making their lives a little better, and how much of your time you'll need to keep for yourself? And you have such a busy schedule. I mean, you're kind of in demand around the world. So I imagine these have been some tough choices for you.
That's a very perceptive comment and question. It is a choice. And I'm not physically able. I don't drive anymore, which is hardship.
Yeah.
If you've driven for a long time and not to have your own wheels, you are isolated to some degree. But I have loving friends who help me drive. But I keep in touch with people as I can by telephone. And there's some people whom I call regularly, and we chat. The phone is a lifeline in many ways. And I just hope and pray that people understand my situation, my predicament, that I can't go to see them.
There were probably times, too, when you might have been too busy.
Yes.
And then you have to decide what's more important, an organization of 80,000 people that you had, or an individual friend who needs you. And these are impossible choices.
Impossible. And there's always a conflict. You're never quite comfortable with the choices that you have to make.
Have you made the choices in both directions?
Yes. That's our human predicament, isn't it?
Maggie Kuhn is my guest, the founder of the Gray Panthers. Many people are very afraid of aging. Have you ever been afraid of getting older?
A bit. And I don't lie about my age. I brag about it. But I am afraid of further physical deterioration and the lack of ability to speak, to read. I have failing vision. And there is a gradual deterioration of physical structure. But fortunately, my mind is still alert.
Is that what scares you the most, though, the thought of losing some of your mental faculties?
Yes. And one of the reasons why I'm very concerned about mental health and the new healthcare system is that we need to know right along, physicians and all other people in the health field need to know about the way in which bodies age and the way in which certain diseases, if not detected and treated, will result in irreversible brain damage. Now, that's inexcusable. We need to know. And when you think that more people are living longer than any time in human history, that you've got increasing numbers of people in their 90s and into their hundreds, we've got to find new ways in which we can maintain the maximum health, holistic health of the body, the mind, and the spirit, until closure.
Do you have a living will?
Yes, I do.
Describe what it is.
A living will is something that I think everyone should have, people of all ages. There are many accidents that take people's lives when they're young. The living will is that you agree with your priest or rabbi or pastor and your lawyer and your physician that you want no extraordinary means used to extend your life when it's clear that closure should come. In my brother's case, I had to fight in one of the teaching hospitals for his right to die. With the the super technology that there is to extend life, it's very tempting to hook people up to another machine. But we need to be wise in planning for our closure and decide when we are in our right minds that we want it to end.
What other planning have you done like that?
Well, I have a will, not only a living will, but an actual will. And I'm willing my two houses, one to the Grey Panthers, one to shared housing. I planned for people to take some of the furniture that there that I've loved and that they might like. And I'm making that a condition of my will, that so-and-so is going to get the sofa and so-and-so is going to get the chair that was in Grandma's front parlor. And that's fun to do, to plan how the things that you've enjoyed and lived with and that you've inherited can be passed on, not just sold out of hand at some auction.
Do you consider it morbid to talk about things like that?
No,
or really necessary to talk about it?
Necessary. And I think that other people should think of that, too, that it's part of long-range planning. We can plan for our closure. I've even decided in my will who should conduct the memorial service and where. And I want it to be, the service itself, I want to be in Morris Arboretum.
Oh, it's beautiful.
With the trees and the flowers that I love. Isn't that a great idea?
Oh, it's beautiful there. It's a wonderful, yes.
And one of my special friends is on the board there, and it'll be such a nice place for people to come.
Do you find that you can talk to younger people about subjects like death as easily as older people?
Not always.
Yeah.
Not always. And you can't always talk to older people about it.
Well, sometimes you don't know how to react when somebody brings it up. You don't know if they want to be reassured that, what are you talking about? That's not going to happen. Or whether they really want to talk about something that's been on their mind, and you don't know what your response should be, you know?
That's precisely the case. There's a denial of age and aging and a denial of closure. It's part of life.
In all the thinking that you've had to challenge, you know, about the stereotypes we have in older people, and I'm sure you've had to challenge the thinking of a lot of older people, too.
Yes, I have. And I think there has been some reassessment in their lives. And one of the things that is a public acclamation and affirmation is the celebration of Older Americans Month.
Which is this month, it's May.
Which is this month.
What does that mean to you?
It means something very special. And I'm delighted that there is affirmation publicly across the country, and in particular communities, of what it means to get old. And that here's a group that not isolated, but that is still a part of the mainstream and still having something to contribute.
In challenging stereotypes and so on, have you been on a campaign to convince older people that their retirement can be different from their preconceptions of retirement?
We have said that retirement is not retirement, but regrouping. It's non-retirement for something from a job that you might not have liked, but it is moving into a new kind of concern and advocacy that is affirming and energizing and contributory to peace and justice in our society.
You like to do something outrageous every week. What are some of the outrageous things you've done in the past couple of years?
Well, I've fired a lot of telegrams to Ronnie Reagan. And some of them were great telegrams, but I never got anything back.
What's an example? What did you say?
I've never heard from him.
Uh-huh.
Maybe his staff protected him from my outrage. But we sent a Valentine to President Bush. It was a very large Valentine. And this was the content of it. It was packed in a big big box, about 5 feet square, beautifully decorated with red hearts. And in it was an empty plate for the hungry, a package of sparklers for the 1,000 points of light. You know, sparklers don't last very long. They go out quickly. A gold-plated toilet seat and wrench for the Pentagon. We made those and decorated them with gilt paper. A bag of 50 pennies for the deficit, you understand? And a home sweet home sampler to go inside the box, which was to house a homeless person.
Did you get any response?
For a long time, we didn't. But last week, we got the pennies back.
How come?
There was a little note, a form letter, about 4 feet, mm-hmm. 4 inches mm-hmm. in diameter, that said, we're not permitted to accept monetary contributions at the White House. We're returning your pennies. So we got them back. We knew that somebody got the Valentine, and we were glad. Now we're dreaming up what we can send to Mr. Bush on Independence Day. We've got a committee working on that. But we're going to remember him and nudge him on every holiday.
Maggie Kuhn, I thank you very, very much for talking with us today. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Terry.